Well, I call your attention this evening to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 12. That's where we will be this evening. We'll be having another parable, and the parable tonight is the rich fool. You should have received a handout. Sometimes I'm able to do this, and sometimes I'm not. Today was one of those days that I was able to do it. If anybody did not get one, if you'll raise your hand, Brother Dave will give you one tonight. Anybody like that did not get a handout? They right over here to my right, your left. There you go. Okay. And got one right here in the middle. We got Brother Dick right over here on this side. We fix and give you some exercise, Dave. All right. And you're retired. You probably need some. Okay. All righty. Right here on the left, Miss Susan, right in the middle. There we go. And then right over there to the right. George, you didn't get one either? You didn't get one? You need one. Okay. All right. Dave will get you one too. Okay. Y'all have to speak up. I'm getting deaf in my old age. All right. There we go. Okay. All right. The Gospel of Luke chapter 12. In this chapter, Jesus is dealing with predominantly two sins. The first 12 verses, he's dealing mainly with what we call the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. When we think of a Pharisee, we think of someone that is hypocritical. Hypocritical, where that on the outward show, they make like that they're spiritual, but on the inside, they're totally different. Jesus said that on the outside, they were whited sepulchers, but on the inside, they were full of dead men's bones. And so that's the first few verses of this chapter. But then he talks about another sin. And this is the sin that probably grabs most of us. I don't think that there's really anybody that is sitting here tonight, and really anybody that I see a whole lot on Sunday morning, that is eaten up with hypocrisy. But I think that we have a battle with this next sin, just like other people have this battle. It is the sin of covetousness. Now, it's amazing to me how that the Bible, when it goes together, how that it's just kind of neat. If you notice, in verse number 11, Jesus is closing out talking about his disciples. And he says, and when they bring you unto the synagogues. So in other words, they are brought by force to the synagogues. Why is that? Because in those synagogues, there was a religious police. There was a religious authority that could penalize other Jews. Do you remember when Paul was going to Damascus? When he was saved on that road in Acts chapter 9, he had letters from the Jewish authorities. And what was he going to do? He was going to bring those Jews back that had fled because they had become Christians. And so we see that there is a religious authority that is mentioned in verse 11 when it comes to the synagogues. And it says, and unto magistrates and powers. So it's not just a religious authority. There are secular authorities. Now, during this time, Israel was under the authority secularly of the Romans. And there are people that live in certain countries. The other night, I was watching some YouTube, and they were talking about a pastor in England, and all he had done was on a TV screen in the church was put some Bible verses that would just scroll through, much like we do on Sunday mornings, except we do our announcements on Sunday mornings. They just had Bible verses that were scrolling through. He was not speaking it from an open mic. But behind him, these Bible verses are going through, and some of them dealt with homosexuality. He was arrested. Is that not nuts? That's crazy for us in this country because we have freedom of speech. I thought about this today. I heard some of the clips from the president when he was speaking in Davos. And there were people that were criticizing him because of all of his, you know, big brash talk about, you know, taking over Greenland, that kind of stuff. And he said today that we're not going to militarily take over Greenland. Basically, he's saying you ought to give it to us. That's what he's saying. But if you don't, then we'll remember it. And so he's getting a lot of flack on some of the social media. And one person wrote on X, I don't have an X account. I've thought about getting one, and I'm thinking if I do, I'll get in trouble. But one person wrote on X, and they said this. They said, why don't you say, we'll stop talking about Greenland when you European countries start giving people free speech and freedom of religion? In other words, you start giving us the freedom that Americans have, and we'll quit some of this other talk. And I thought, you know, that's a pretty good response right there. Because in our country, we have the freedom of speech. Now, you can't yell fire like in a theater, the old saying goes. But you can say pretty much what you want. Now, didn't think about that until just this second, but let me just throw this in here. In Minneapolis, there were protesters that came into a church. What would we do if that happened here? I'm watching the clips of that as well, and I'm going, could I have been as kind as that pastor was? It could be that, you know, there would be too many for the security to handle. But I just believe that if that happened here, that we would let them know this is private property and you're about to be prosecuted. We're going to start taking pictures of you and we're going to prosecute you because we're here to try to worship God and you're here to cause trouble. This is not a public property. This is private property. It was paid for by the tithes and offerings of God's people at Corinth Baptist Church. And it is their property, not yours. Now, you're welcome to come and worship with us, but you do it under our authority. We're happy to have guests. We have guests all the time. We want guests to continue. But you're not going to come in and take over like you own this place. And so, anyway, that was free tonight. I hadn't even planned on saying that till it hit me about 2 minutes ago. And so I want us to remember that verse 11 is kind of right before what's about to come. Now, the first thing that I want you to remember is that when trouble does come, the Holy Spirit will give you the words to say. That's what I'm counting on. Now, number one tonight, I want you to see the row. Not the row, the row. I don't know, I was trying to think now, can you put a pronunciation in parentheses so people will know that? And to be honest with you, I don't know how to write ow. I know how to say it, but I don't know how to write it. And so I thought, okay, this is the way I'll do it. It will be not like rowing a boat, but like the English whenever they have a row. And that is basically, there is a fight that is going on. We see that in verse number 13. Now remember, the authorities are religious and the authorities are secular in verse 11 and 12. And so now we have a man that is unknown. He is an anonymous man. And it says, he said, he was just one of the company. He said unto him, Jesus, Master, speak to my brother. Now, I do not know if the brother is there. I don't know if he wants Jesus to take a trip with him. But I know that there is trouble in the family. And so this shout comes out immediately after the authority in the synagogue and the magistrates and the powers that are governing. And he says that he divide the inheritance with me. Very few things cause more trouble in a family than money. I'm purposely getting a drink of water so you can think about that. When you think about people that you have known, how many times has there been a schism in the family over an inheritance? One of the blessings that me and my sister had was that our mama was poor as Job's turkey. When it was all said and done, I got $800 and Caroline got $800. That was the end of my mom's inheritance. If they would have been hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think that we would have still done it the same way, because she and I, in all of her years, I'm 13 years older than her, from the time she was born until now, she and I have never had a fuss about anything. So I think that would have been okay. But can I tell you, that's not the case in many families. Read the story this afternoon about a family from the Midwest. And there were like four girls in the family. And one of the girls went off to college. The other three decided not to go off to college. They all married and kind of stayed around the home. And the one that went off to college, she married a guy and they lived in a different city. Well, then the father died. And so when the one that lived out of town came in, she began to notice that all over the house, the furniture and some of the valuable things that were in the house would have little post-it notes that would be on it. And it would call, and it would be written down, and it would call out the girl's name that said, "Well, I want that. I want that. I want that." And the one from out of town, she was like, "Man, my dad is barely gone. And they're just like vultures." And her husband decided to handle it this way. And I thought this was pretty good. He said, "We're all here at the table and everybody is talking about what's important to them and what they want." And he said, "And this is what I want. And this is what my wife wants." And he got up and he walked over and stood behind his mother-in-law and he put his hands on her shoulder and said, "This is who we want." And of course, everybody else went silent. And I'm thinking, I don't know if they got anything, but that's a good answer. That is a good answer. And so you've got this man, and he says, "My brother will not give me what I want." Now, what this tells me is it tells me that this has to do with the law of inheritance. Now, remember, biblically, the law of inheritance was this: the firstborn got twice as much as the other children. You say, why is that? Well, the reason is because the firstborn was the one that was considered in that culture to be the one that that showed the potency of a family. It was the one that that opened the womb. That's a phrase that's used in Exodus. But the main reason is that the oldest boy had to take care of his mother. And he also had to take care of any unmarried sisters. And so that's why he received a double portion. And if you want to think about somebody, you could think about the prodigal son. The prodigal son was the younger son. Now the older boy had problems that were of a different nature. And so when the other boy, the oldest one, said, "I don't know why you're giving him this," and his dad said, "Son, you're forever with me." But the Bible tells us at the beginning of Luke 15 that he gave both the boys their inheritance. So that meant that the older boy got twice as much as the younger one did. Now the younger one, he went off and squandered it. You know that story. And I may preach on that in a few weeks. But the picture that we have here is probably a boy that is wanting to do something very similar. When people get a bunch of money, sometimes they do stupid stuff. If you doubt that, all you got to do is look at some professional athletes. I read about some of these guys in the NBA, and I don't want to start calling names because of the embarrassment of it or whatever, but there was one guy that played for the Hawks for years, millions and millions of dollars that he made. And when he finally had to quit playing basketball, his credit was so bad he couldn't even buy an automobile. His brother played in the NBA also. He never had the all-star status that his brother did that made all that money. But they asked him, they said, how did you manage your money? And he said, well, basically, I didn't let my mama and sister manage it. I wrote and signed my own checks, and that was some advice that is wise advice. But sometimes fast money is fast gone. And this guy's wanting fast money here. And then Jesus, he refuses to intervene. He says in verse 14, man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? Well, I want you to look with me at Psalm 72, verse 2. Psalm 72, verse 2. I hope I wrote this down right. He shall judge thy people with righteousness, and thy poor with judgment or discernment. Who is the he there? It's Messiah. So you have this man that comes to Jesus, and he says, tell my brother to give me my inheritance. And Jesus goes, man, what have I got to do with that? Jesus, we know, is Messiah. But why did parables begin in the first place? Because they rejected the Lord's Messiahship. They said, you're not the Christ. And the leaders in Israel got the people to go along with that. And so Jesus began to speak in parables. And so you've got Jesus, and he says, basically, without saying it, you rejected me. I have no authority to make that decision for you or to tell your brother anything. So he would not take the bait. It could be that also he just did not want to intervene. If you want to be the bad guy, get in between family members. Bad place to be. I've had people, and they've said, preacher, we need you to come to our house. I was telling Brother Keith about this yesterday. Said, we need you to come to our house. We've got some money, and we want you to tell us what to do with it. We've got two boys, and I don't know if we're going to give those boys anything. And, you know, we've got some things we're thinking about doing, but we want you to tell us what to do. And in my mind, I'm thinking, no, don't go, don't go. Because if something happens, it doesn't matter what happens. Somebody's going to be upset. And I'm thinking, Lord, how am I going to get out of this? And I don't know how I'm going to get out of it, but I'm getting out of it. I don't want to be in the middle of a man and his wife. I don't want to be in the middle of a sibling and a sibling. I don't want to be in the middle of any of that, because you're going to be the bad guy. And so Jesus doesn't take the bait, and he basically is not going to facilitate this guy. If he wants to become another prodigal, he's not going to say, here's the money, go act like a heathen. And so we see the row. But there's a second thing that we see. We see the reality. Now, this is where our parable comes in tonight. Verse number 15, he says this, "And he, Jesus, said unto them, Take heed and beware of covetousness." Now, remember, the first sin that he really dealt with in this chapter was hypocrisy. But now he is dealing with covetousness, which we would say is hoarding or stinginess. You know, the old joke is that, that guy still got the first nickel he ever made. Or he squeezes a nickel so tight that the buffalo will grunt. That type of thing. Beware of covetousness. Well, what is that? Well, in the Big Ten Commandments, the last one, you're not supposed to covet. Later on in the Mosaic Law, he talks about you're not supposed to covet a man's wife, you're not supposed to covet his animals, you're not supposed to covet what another man has. And so it's the desire to have more and more and more. And so I want you to notice, beginning in verse 17, some pronouns. And I've circled these in my Bible, and I don't know if you want to do that or if you want to highlight it, but I want you to notice how this man speaks. Verse 17, he's thinking this within himself. What shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. Verse 18. And he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. Verse 19, and I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. If I counted that right, that's at least 9 times that an I or a my is used. Now, before we get too judgmental, what does our prayer life look like? How many times is it just simply a wish list? You know, I'm bad about criticizing the charismatics with the health, wealth, and prosperity. But is our prayers similar to that? Lord, I've got this pain in my side. Lord, I got this pain in my leg. And instead of taking time like we talked about whenever I preached through the Lord's Prayer, I forget when I did that, how that, you know, we ought to take time to thank God and praise God, and then we get into the petitions. But sometimes, I mean, that's just like, boom, right out of the chute. Lord, I need you to give me some money. And when he gives you money, sometimes we squander the money. I think sometimes about, you know, the way that I'm a steward of the money that God gives to me and my wife. And I guess probably in the years that we've been married, and she's asked me, she said, what is it that you would like to do different if you could do it again? First of all, she said, would you do it again? I said, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. I would marry you again in a heartbeat. I would take the same kids that I had in a heartbeat. I would take the same occupation that I have in a heartbeat. She said, well, what would you do different? And I said, well, 2 things come to mind. Number one, I'd like another shot at that boy of ours. He's giving me a run for my money. And I know boys and girls are different. I know that. And he's never been disrespectful. Like I said, he and I had lunch together and we just chatted and just laughed about some things. It was fun. But I'd like to have another chance to put a few more things in there. But the main thing that I would like a second shot at, I told Debbie, I said, I wish I'd have been better with the stewardship of our money. I don't mind being generous to a fault, but I have squandered a lot. She's squandered a lot. we could have been better. Those are the two things. I think this guy went to the other extreme. And so the reality is that this man is, he has been blessed. But Jesus begins, before he tells this story, he says that a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. Now that smacks in the face of these people that are listening to him. It was a common belief in Judaism that the more money you had, that was a surefire way that God has been pleased with you. So the more you had, the more God liked you. That was the belief that they had. And so the material blessings, it was something that on the face of it, they thought, well, yeah, that's great. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having material blessings as long as they don't have you. I've told people before, in my hands, I have had come through, and the amount of money that I've been responsible for as far as saying spend this or save that or whatever with the church and at home, we've probably had probably $1 million or $2 that have come through. And I tell the church, thank God none of it ever stuck. And you and I, we ought to have the mindset that, well, we're not going to hoard it. We're not going to be stingy. We're going to be generous because God gave it to us. God's blessed us. If we die tonight, God's been good to us. God's just been good to us. And so the reality of this is something that we got to watch our prayer life. Now, there are three mistakes that this man made. Now, these three points, this little outline that I've got underlined for you, I wish it was original with me, but it's not. It came from John Phillips. I love John Phillips. He's an old English preacher. He actually preached for us one time at the old church when he was in America. He preached for us, and I'm telling you, he was just different. There's very few people that I can say that about, but John Phillips was one of those guys. And so his outline is what I have underlined on your notes tonight. Number one, he valued his bank book more than his Bible. Look at verse 16. And he spake a parable unto them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. So in other words, his land was very productive. All land is not created equal. There are times that farmers have had land, and it has just been horrible. There's a guy that I know about named Joel Salatin. I don't know if you've ever heard that name, but he's kind of like the guru of kind of like natural farming. He's one of those guys. And he said that his dad had been a missionary in, I think it was, might have been Guatemala. And the communists took over with a revolution, and they basically got out of Dodge with the clothes that they could put on in a suitcase and get out of town. They had to leave everything that they had down on the mission compound. So they came back to the States. They had people that lived in Virginia. And he said, so that's where my dad said, let's go. And they found a piece of property that was just horrible. He said there were ravines there that were 30, 40 feet deep. Nothing was growing on it. Basically, the land had been raped. And he said, but that was the only thing that my dad could afford. So he began to use rotational grazing and that kind of thing. And he said, you look at it now, and it's plush. But it's because it took years and years and years of doing things the same way. He said, in 40 years, there's never been a bag of agricultural fertilizer put here. This is all natural. Well, their farm is called polyface. And the reason they call it polyface is because it's multifaceted. They got cows and they got pigs and they got chickens. They got turkeys, they got ducks. I don't know if they have quail or not, but they've got all kind of livestock. Well, this man had a farm that had great, great nutrients evidently in the ground. And when he would plant something, it would just come up. And it came up so much that it was plentifully. The crops were always good. And so when you think about that, you think, okay, he's thinking that he is the guy that made that happen. You read that when you read those pronouns, the eyes and the mice. Look what I've done. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll tear down my barns. I'll rebuild and I'll have more of my barns. And so he's got value in the things that he's got more so than what the Bible teaches. Now, we won't get deep into the Bible and what we're to do with money. It's not a Larry Burkett message tonight. This is something that I just want you to just pick up on. The Bible speaks often of trying to help others and being generous. If you look at the Mosaic Law, what does it say? It talks about the poor people. You leave some around the edge of the field so that they can get some to eat. It's kind of like on the Sabbath day controversy when those disciples are walking through and they took the heads of wheat and they would rub it and then they would eat the kernels and let the husk blow away. Well, in those ancient times, story of Ruth, prime example of that. What did Boaz tell his servants that were picking the fields? Said, I want you to pour some piles out around the edge, and I want you to leave that girl some handfuls on purpose. That's where that phrase comes from. You hear me talk about sometimes just handfuls on purpose? It comes right out of the book of Ruth. And so you've got a man that valued his bank book more than his Bible. Number two, he valued his body more than his soul. Look at verse 19. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine, eat, drink, and be merry. Now, let me ask you a question. You can eat food in your body. You can drink in your body. How do you do that with a soul? You don't do it with physical food. You don't do it with physical liquid. If you're going to get fed spiritually, that's a different way. But here, he is valuing his body more than his soul, even though he says soul, like he's speaking to himself. Now, can I ask you a question? What can a soul that is an engineering for spiritual things, I guess maybe would be a way to say that, what is a soul, what is it going to do with a barn? You think about that for a minute. Soul is spiritual. You can't really reach out and grab it. It's something that is real. You have a soul. I have a soul. But if you're going to eat, drink, and be merry, you're probably going to think more in terms of doing that in your body. Because souls don't enjoy hamburgers. Souls don't enjoy Coca-Colas. Souls don't enjoy looking at a big barn. Now, the flesh does. I think it's neat whenever I go and somebody's got them a big barn that they've built. I'm thinking, man, that would be nice in my backyard. Border on covetousness. I mean, I'm thinking right now, if me and Debbie ever sold our place and we rebuilt, I'd want some land and I'd want a shop that was three times as big as the one I got right now. Want a house about a third of what I got right now, but a shop about three times as big as I got right now. That's what I'm thinking. And so he valued his body more than his soul. Now, the crazy thing is he had no room to bestow his fruits anymore. In other words, his barns were already full. Does there ever come a time when enough is enough? There ought to come a time when it's that much. I heard one guy that was a multimillionaire. Somebody asked him, they said, how much is enough? He said, just one more million. And I'm thinking, surely there's got to come a time when you go, I can do something else with this. And so he valued his body more than his soul. The third thing, he valued his time here more than eternity. Look again at verse 19. For many years. Now this is a spiritual bunch that's here tonight. But what is the mindset of most people? Well, yeah, I'm going to die, but that's way out there. I think that. You probably think that. I'm 69 years old. My next birthday, I'll hit the big 7-0. But in my mind, I'm thinking, I can make 90. That's what I'm thinking. But in reality, I may not make 70. You just don't know. But we think that. And he's thinking, man, I got many more years. And what am I going to do with those years? I'm going to eat and drink, and I'm going to be merry. I'm going to be happy. I'm going to enjoy my retirement. This past Saturday, there were two funerals. I did one over in Decatur for Becky's mom, Miss Beverly. But down in Sylvania, Georgia, Brother Ricky and Miss Pam, their son-in-law, his stepdad died. And so they went down to the funeral in Sylvania. This man was 62. He had retired 1 week prior, and his wife found him in a recliner 1 week after he retired. 62 years old. He had not yet drawn his first retirement check, and he was gone. He was in eternity. And so this man, he valued his time here more than he did eternity. Can I tell you that he was a bankrupt man and did not know it? When he died, there was not a single thing that he took with him. Not a thing. Everybody but him. Everybody that was left but him. He was gone. And what are they doing? They're using what he had. All the man's wealth couldn't buy him one extra day. I think about this. There was an article on the CNBC website. It was a written article. It was written maybe 5 years ago. And it said this. The title of it was Cheating Death. Cheating Death. They talked about the different billionaires, how that they are investing heavily so that their lives can be prolonged, and some of them even to the point to where they are seeking immortality. Guys like Jeff Bezos, these are some of the names that were mentioned. Larry Ellison. In more recent days, I've been hearing Elon Musk talk about that kind of stuff, where that they could take a chip and insert it into a human and somehow take the soul and store that until they can come up with a solution for maybe malady that they had in their body. Transhuman type stuff. And I hear that kind of thing, and all I'm thinking is, if these guys had a faith in the Lord, that stuff wouldn't matter, because ultimately they're going to have eternal existence somewhere. Now this man, I said that he was bankrupt, and I mean he was bankrupt spiritually. Because Jesus, in telling this, he said, God said that he was a fool. He was a fool. And so that brings me to my third thing, a reflection. The reflection. Look with me at verse 20. And God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. then who shall those things be which thou hast provided? All of those barns that you're talking about building, who's going to own them? All of the grain that's in those silos, who's going to eat it? Who's going to get the profit if you decided to sell it in the market? Who's going to get the profit? Not you. And so God calls him a fool because he has laid up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Life is not about possessions. Solomon experienced everything that this world could offer. That's what the whole book of Ecclesiastes is about. I want you to look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun. In other words, when I went to work, I had long hours. It was just pressure, pressure, pressure. I hated it. Then he says, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. In other words, everything that Solomon had accumulated, he just thought it's just emptiness. Because when I die, others are going to be using it. Nobody probably on the pages of history, or not history, biblical history, probably had any more money than Solomon. He had so much money that he was putting gold plate on chariots. He had other nations like Hiram. He was the king up in around Lebanon. He was sending literally just wagon loads of gold to Solomon every year. Whenever they needed some wood to help with the construction of that first temple, what does Hiram do? Hey, take these cedars of Lebanon. They floated them down the coastline of the Mediterranean, pulled them out at Joppa, and carried them over to Jerusalem. And that's where they began to put those together. This man had money. I don't know how to compare he and Job or he and Abraham, but he was loaded. And yet here he is in verse 18 of chapter 2 in Ecclesiastes saying that he hated the fact that everything that he had worked for was going to belong to somebody else. Now there are times when I think about my demise and my wife's demise, and I think, well, what's going to happen? And I think that I've got it planned, you know, so that the three kids will get their portion equally. I think I've got it planned that way. But I know that if I did not have kids, and the things that we have accumulated, which is not much, but it's a little, I'm just thinking, when we're both gone, I have no idea who's going to get it, the state. That could be what it is. And so he says that he hated it because I should leave it unto the man that's coming after me. In that particular situation, it was a man named Rehoboam, which was one of his sons. And so he said, thou fool, that tonight your life's like a vapor. He would be dead before morning, and all the things that he accumulated were done. Now, the greatest tragedy is not really what he left. The greatest tragedy is what was laying before him, and an eternity without God. You think about the wealthiest people that you have ever known. My sister worked for a man, and I think he was probably the man that's had more money than anybody that I've ever known. I don't know exactly how much Paul had, but let me just tell you this. He had two houses on Sea Island. They got guards keeping the riffraff out on Sea Island. You say, how do you know? Because my sister worked for him, and she let us, or she got his permission to let us stay in one of the smaller, one of the two smaller houses that he owned. And my name had to be on the list, or I couldn't have got on that island. But that was just two of his homes. He owned another one up in Maine. He owned another one out in Texas. And just for the fun of it, he owned one in Scotland. Every one of them had their own vehicles. His family had all of the clothes that they needed at each one of those locations. They could fly from Maine to Texas and not even have to pack a suitcase. Every one of them had maintenance people that would come in, and they would always, I mean, if he didn't go one someplace but for a month a year, that air condition was serviced, the heaters were serviced, all the lights were making sure that they're all burning, making sure that all the carpets were clean, all the beds were made, and when those kids left those places, the cleaning crew would come in, all the clothes would be washed, they would be rehung, they would be put back in the dressers, and they're off to another location. He did not want to drive, or didn't want to fly from Maine to Sea Island, because he had in the trunk of his car, he had gold bullion. He said, if I get on an airplane with this, they're going to confiscate it. So he had a little bitty woman about the size of Kim that was his driver. And he and his wife would sit in the back seat, and this little lady would drive him. She drove them from Maine to Sea Island, and in the trunk of that car, there was $1.2 million in gold bullion. And he said, I just didn't want the government taking it if I got on an airplane. I've never known anybody else that had that kind of juice. But Paul died. His wife died. And one of the biggest fusses that you've ever seen was them kids over that inheritance. And I told Caroline, I said, it's good that Mama left us $800 apiece so that we didn't go through that kind of stuff. And so this man, he died and he didn't know God. How sad is it? Mark chapter 8, I believe it is, says, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world but he loses his own soul? This man was rich toward the world, but he was not rich toward God. So what does that phrase mean at the end of 21? I believe that it means that it's the opposite of what this man did. I think it's somebody that takes from their material blessings to try to help other people. I think there comes a time when enough's enough and we can do good. R.G. Letourneau is one of the guys that I first learned about when I got saved. He'd been dead for years when I got saved. He started Letourneau College, and he began a construction company, and he began to build bridges, and he developed a lot of huge equipment, and they built these bridges, and he started that company, and he was a Christian. He said, Dear God, if you will bless my company, I will tithe on our money. And God blessed him. And Letourneau's own testimony was that God began to bless us so much that I just decided that I'd give 20% instead of 10. Then it was blessed so much that he said, well, why don't I just give 30% to God's work? Then it got to 50%. And toward the end of Letourneau's life, he was giving 90% and he was living on 10%. You say, that is crazy. It is. I tell you something else that's crazy. How many of you have ever heard anybody denigrate the Rockefellers? Anybody? Where y'all been? I've heard people denigrate like John D. Rockefeller. Oh man, the government came in and broke up Standard Oil. John D. Rockefeller was the wealthiest man that really probably ever lived until maybe Elon. He gave to charity the last year of his life more than anybody else in the nation made. He gave, I think it was $586 million the last year of his life to charity. Nobody else in the country even made that. And they asked him, they said, "Mr. Rockefeller, what is the thing that you are most proud of?" And they thought, well, he's going to say Standard Oil, you know, how that they developed, you know, the gasoline. And then later on, there's like from the residue of the gasoline, these other companies were tossing it in the river. And he hired scientists to come up with it. And that's why you have things like Vaseline and Chapstick today. That came from John D. Rockefeller's scientist. And so they said, "What are you most proud of?" He said, "Well, when I was 15 years old, I trusted Jesus as my Savior." He said, "I guess the second thing that I'm most proud of," he said, "I married the best woman in the world." He said, "That's what I'm most proud of." He never worked on Sunday. I guess he was like Truett Cathy. He just simply loved the Lord. Now, we don't hear that about him, but I read a biography about him, and that was one of the things that came out in that biography. And the guy that wrote it was not even writing it as a religious book. I mean, he was writing about the wealthiest people. It's called The Myth of the Robber Barons. And so John D. Rockefeller, he was most proud of being a Christian. And then he was most proud of being married to the same woman for all those many years. And do you know what else he did? He was a Sunday school teacher in the First Baptist Church that he was a member of up near Chicago. That's pretty cool. That was a man that knew how to make it, and he knew how to give. And so he was rich toward God. And examples in the Bible, Mary, Martha, Lazarus, every time Jesus came through Bethany, that was the house that he stayed at. There was a group of women that followed Jesus from place to place to place. And when there was a financial need, they gave out of what they had to help that ministry survive. This church has widows just like that. They give generously. But some of them are like the widow's mite. God has used people in miraculous ways when they were not rich in this world's goods, but they were rich toward God. This man was a fool. I pray we're not.